We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
From your favorite source for Chicago White Sox talk, delivering news, interviews, analysis, and more. This is the Sox Machine Podcast with your hosts, Jim Margulis and Josh Nelson.
Thanks, Rob, and welcome to the Sox Machine Podcast. I'm your host, Josh Nelson, and it's Thursday night, February 1st, 2024, as we bring you a new episode. There's not much White Sox news on the field, but we have updates about the White Sox new stadium plans. As Related Midwest, the real estate developer, is pushing hard for a new stadium in the South Loop as they have met with Illinois state leaders recently. We at Sox Machine have heard from the 11th Ward office in Bridgeport of Nicole Lee and what their strategy is in keeping the White Sox at their current location at 35th and Shields. We'll share those details, plus talk about why there are big free agents still available as spring training is just a couple weeks away, and if old friends Tim Anderson and Yasmani Grandal will find new homes by then. But first, on Thursday night, the Athletics' Ken Rosenthal and ESPN's Jeff Passan did most of the heavy lifting, reporting that the Baltimore Orioles, who just agreed to a new sale to new owners on Wednesday, have acquired Milwaukee Brewers ace pitcher Corbin Burnes. How does this trade shake out and the impacts on White Sox GM's Chris Getz's attempt to move Dylan Cease? Well, joining me to discuss is the managing editor of SoxMachine.com. It's Jim Margulis. And hello, Jim. Man, the Baltimore Orioles have been busy the last couple of days. Nice to see one blockbuster trade prior to spring training starting.
Yeah, and coming on the heels of an ownership change, like kind of a sale or a partial sale that basically moves John Angelos out of the picture. And yeah, he sounded miserable running the team. Yeah. As much fun as he should have in Baltimore with the ballpark that they have, striking the new lease that goes up to 30 years and having this division winning talent with paired with the still the number one farm system by some rankings, a payroll that's still under 100 million. Like, that should be the ideal situation for any owner saying, like, yeah, we did it right. We are currently in a position to strike and be good for a long time. And he just sounded so miserable whining about TV deals and attendance and how he wasn't going to be able to maintain any of the players or, you know, hold on to them because of, you know, the contract. So enjoy this run while it lasts because the game's economics are so unfair. And then he goes and sells to two hedge fund billionaires for 1.7 plus million. And it sounds like they're excited to run the team and injecting a lot of positive energy. And then sure enough, yes, a day after that, they do strike for the starter they've needed. I think White Sox fans were hoping it'd be Dylan Cease, but Corbin Burnes is like, you know, he's Dylan Cease. He's probably a little bit better than Dylan Cease if you're looking for like a rock of rotation. The difference is 1 year of team control versus two, but depends on what kind of starter you want and the discounted price the Orioles paid relative to what the White Sox seem to be asking for Cease. Like, it's a deal that makes sense for him.
The Baltimore Orioles have World Series aspirations in 2024. And as we saw last year, they're really good. Like, they're really good. So I don't think it's crazy to say they have World Series aspirations for this season. If you were in their shoes, Jim, let's take our White Sox caps off for a moment. Who would you rather have if you have, if you are a team with World Series aspirations like Baltimore? Corbin Burnes or Dylan Cease?
I think I would rather have Burnes just because of the price they paid. Like, I think there's a lot of value to Cease having 2 years of team control, but he also, he's less efficient than Burnes when it comes to starting, you know, lasting in a start. Like, Burnes throws about like 20 more innings more a year, roughly, than Cease does. Walks fewer batters, strikes out about the same. So you kind of know that the guy you're getting is probably going to be able to go six innings instead of five, seven innings, or at least six and two thirds instead of six, which counts. Like, when you have a bullpen like Baltimore does, and they saw that with Bautista's late season injury, you don't want to wear it down by having so many starters that can only throw 150 innings. Like, you want to have one guy who stands a chance of throwing 200 or at least rounding up to 200, and Burnes gives them that. So I think Cease, like, offers a little bit more upside for maybe dominance with, like, you know, really, you know, filthy strikeout totals. Well, Burnes did that, you know, a couple years ago. So maybe Burnes can rediscover that too, the way that, you know, Cease's strikeout total dropped off a little bit. They're close, I think, but yeah, I think with the young pitchers they have and with the, you know, pitchers still to call up, like, I still think they need somebody who could deliver innings and be like a guy you don't mind having throw 110 plus pitches, because that 110 pitches is probably going to get you a six plus to seven innings, versus like when Cease throws 110, like maybe he finishes six in a typical start, especially like in a division where they might fall off a lot of pitches and really might extend at bats. So yeah, it makes sense, I think, for the Brewers to not worry so much about next year. If really the only prospects they sent, Joey Ortiz and DL Hall, plus a draft pick the White Sox didn't have, yeah, that's something the White Sox couldn't offer, was a draft pick. If the draft capital really appealed to the Brewers, you know, and really, like, or sorry, really appealed to the, or the White Sox really couldn't talk about that too much. Like, that, I think, is really something that, you know, makes sense. So if, I think when it comes to what's left now, it's like, now that Burnes is, Burnes is out of the market, like, I don't know if Cease has really any peers, but I think between the two of them, if you're only giving up Joey Ortiz, who the Orioles couldn't use anyway, and DL Hall, who Burnes replaces effectively, then yeah, that's a hard trade for the Orioles to pass up.
Yeah, I really like this deal for Baltimore. Now they have Burnes to oppose Gerrit Cole in those critical division matchups in the 2024 season. For Milwaukee, as Jim mentioned, even though Joey Ortiz plays shortstop, the early indications out of Milwaukee is that Ortiz is going to get some playing time at third base in the major leagues this year. DL Hall, who is out of the Baltimore's bullpen the last couple of years, moves into the starting rotation for the Milwaukee Brewers. And we'll see what the Brewers do with the 35th pick in the draft, which I love that the draft pick is involved, because if you have been listening to this podcast for years, I have been campaigning for Major League Baseball to allow trading of draft picks. Like, if teams could freely trade draft picks, then maybe Chris Getz gets a deal that he would like for Dylan Cease, in which teams would be more willing to trade first round picks, because even though they have those picks and they're hoping to count on that money, at this stage, we don't know what that bonus lot value is. We don't know what your bonus money is going to be. But you know your prospects. You've been spending a lot of time developing them. Maybe teams would be more freely giving up first-round picks than top prospects. And where the White Sox currently are, reloading, rebuilding, whatever, maybe they'd rather have those first-round picks than a 21-year-old prospect in high A.
Yeah. One thing that jumped out at me initially, I was thinking that the prospect was, or the draft pick was going the other way, and then I corrected course. But the White Sox, I think that draft pick would hold extra appeal this year, now that I'm thinking it through a little bit. With the White Sox missing out or getting on the wrong end of the lottery and not being able to pick higher than 10th next year, like, that's a case where having the 34th overall pick could hold extra appeal. now that the lottery, you know, teams can't really stack lottery picks year after year the way they used to, having that extra first round pick, making up some of the money that they lose by not having a top five pick versus a top 10 or 15 pick. Like, that's a case where you could really shape or mold some trade packages in ways that they couldn't before. So that's something I wonder if the White Sox, when they were talking with the Orioles, I wonder if they talked about getting that draft pick or getting some extra capital, or if they just really wanted prospects and only, you know, prospects in their current form.
Because with the draft capital, even though it's for this upcoming July draft and the White Sox already have the fifth overall pick, that extra bonus slot value, if they really like someone, mm-hmm. and it sounds like they're going to go third overall because that team could offer more money, well, the White Sox would have more money in their draft pool with that pick. Yeah. So they could really get who they wanted in this upcoming 2024 MLB draft. But alas, the Milwaukee Brewers get this pick. So I keep asking this question, like, what is Milwaukee's game plan? But this could end up being a savvy move if Joey Ortiz proves to be a league average hitter. We know defensively, all the reports out of Norfolk is that he's going to be a solid defender at shortstop. If he could stick at third base and be a league average offensive player, that's an everyday player the Milwaukee Brewers have for years. D.L. Hall, they got years of control. And now they gain an extra first-round pick for 1 year of Corbin Burnes. So Milwaukee Brewers could come out, they could be happy about mm-hmm. this exchange for 1 year with Burnes, because the Brewers had zero interest in extending Corbin Burnes after the season. But you mentioned that now there's no other peers for Dylan Cease in the trade market. How does this trade impact Chris Getz's opportunity in moving Dylan Cease prior to spring training?
I think that's a good question. It was a question I opened, or not opened with, but I included in my February is here, what are the White Sox going to do? What are they doing, et cetera, post I had on Thursday morning, just talking about, like, every time a trade partner pops up, the Mariners were the most recent one.
Yeah.
Within 24 hours, they trade for Jorge Polanco. They send a top 100 outfielder Minnesota's way, and like, well, that's a guy who might have been interesting for the White Sox to fill out a potential trade proposal. And now, the Mariners might, not really have as much to offer as they did. So that probably doesn't work. So I'm inclined to think like that, as these partners whittle down, and as Blake Snell and Jordan Montgomery are still in the market, just costing only cash, and maybe their prices are getting lower, although with Scott Boras clients, in the case of Snell, like, you never know, like, he tends to pull out the deal when you least expect it. I think the chances are more and more likely that he probably does start the season, Cease does, with the White Sox.
Yeah, that Seattle reported deal, I just figured that it was Seattle kicking the tires. Like, you know what? Let's have some fun here. We already have a great starting rotation, right?
Yeah.
Let's see what it would take to get Dylan Cease and make a super starting rotation, because Seattle right now is what? The third team in the American League West behind Houston and Texas. Like, you still like Houston and Texas more than Seattle. So Seattle, even though they have a very good team, they have a very tough fight on their hands coming up to the season. So it's not crazy that one strategy is let's make a super starting rotation. But there's also a part of me that just wonders, Jim, is Jerry Dipoto bored, and was he just antsy that he hasn't made a trade in a while?
Mm-hmm.
That's why he called Chris Getz and, hey, I'm kind of interested in Dylan Cease. Yeah. But then
he had the shakes.
He said 24 hours later, he gets Jorge Polanco for the Minnesota Twins, which, good for Seattle. We know how dangerous Polanco could be, but I really like that return for Minnesota as far as being able to get some depth. They shed a little cash on their payroll. The question in Minneapolis, though, is are Twins owners going to spend that $6.5 million that they saved, or are they just going to put it in whatever fund and maybe they can add players at the deadline if they're in position to win the division, or they want to enhance their odds of winning another playoff series in the postseason if they make it that far? We'll see. But that's all I took from the Seattle curiosity in Dylan Cease, is that I didn't really think it was a serious trade partner, just that, Jerry Dipoto was bored and he's kicking the tires to see what's out there.
Yeah, I mean, look at the rest of the market too, like maybe the Yankees, maybe like the teams we've been talking about as like the secondary contenders after the Dodgers, who found pitching, now after the Orioles found pitching. You just kind of go down the list a little bit, like the Cardinals still need something, but they're not a great match necessarily. Braves could maybe use somebody besides Chris Sale, but also they're not a great match. The Rays have a lot of interest, but typically they don't make that kind of deal. They tend to send guys the other way when they're about to reach free agency or within a couple of years. So, yeah, that's why I'm thinking it's more and more likely that Cease, you know, starts the season with the White Sox and then is the best pitcher on the market probably when the trade deadline comes around, unless like Jesus Luzardo becomes more available, depending right. on which way the Marlins go with their new administration. He's really the only peer right now. I do think looking at this Burns return, it's an okay return for Milwaukee, and the Brewers had every reason to hold on to Burns. Like there's no reason to trade him earlier because they've been winning divisions. They've been, you know, having real postseason, aspirations and deep postseason run aspirations. So like, there's no reason to trade him beforehand. This is more a case of like, well, you know, we're kind of in between now. So which way do we go? And they decide to trade Burns now, but the return isn't really that impressive. Like Ortiz might not be a major league starter or at least a major league regular. Hall is kind of a tweener. Like he posts huge strikeout numbers, but doesn't seem to necessarily have like the efficiency to start, like, you know, really pile up the innings the way you want a starter to do. So it'll be worth keeping an eye on him to see if the Brewers can unlock something the Orioles weren't quite able to do to get five innings with regularity out of him. But like, if he clicks, like he could be a monster. So it does make some sense, but you can see a case too, where like the Orioles don't get like a real fixture out of this deal for their best starter. And it's just kind of a trade to make, yeah, trade they kind of had to make, but, you know, if they wanted to maximize his return, they should have done it either a half season earlier or a year earlier. There's no reason for them to do that. Just only talking about the return. In this case for the White Sox, it's instructive because the White Sox could deal Cease now. They could deal him at the deadline. They could have dealt him at the last deadline. Like they've had this sliding scale of like, when is the best time to trade him? And so I think you're seeing now what the return might be like if the White Sox let the trade deadline pass too. And you get all the way to 1 year remaining. And it's like, well, you know, Ortiz and Hall aren't bad. And they're excited, you know, at least with Hall, he's got some excitement to him. But there's also like a high bust factor for both. You know, if you're hoping for a regular, that I think might be a little bit uncomfortable for like having Cease as long as the White Sox had in a position to deal him. So if it turns out that the White Sox don't deal Cease this winter or spring and he starts the season with them, then I think it really becomes incumbent on Chris Getz to really start priming the trade deadline for him, even if like late June you're talking, like just, you know, maybe even earlier when it comes to what teams could really use a pitcher. Like be ready to deal him, because like that, it really is important to try to get that extra half season, the extra postseason for Cease to matter, because otherwise the price will go down quite a bit.
We're all in a holding pattern when it comes to Dylan Cease and what this offseason meant for the Chicago White Sox. But in a future podcast episode, right around when spring training starts, we'll recap the White Sox offseason. And so essentially we're giving the White Sox front office a couple more weeks to do something. And again, read Jim's post on SoxMachine.com as we enter February. We'll talk more about the players that are available, even old friends as well. But the next topic, and this is by far the biggest topic when it concerns the Chicago White Sox, because they're not doing much on the field or in transaction news, the latest stadium update. So since we last spoke last week about the White Sox flirting with the idea of moving to the South Loop, there have been a few new reporting developments. From the Chicago Sun-Times, they reported that Related Midwest, who is the real estate developer, spoke with Illinois House Speaker Chris Welch and Illinois Senate President Don Harmon. Related Midwest is not asking for state money, according to the Sun-Times, but rather they want the Illinois Sports Facilities Authority, commonly known as the ISFA, to be granted authority to rearrange existing bonds that are currently for guarantee rate field, extending those bonds over to the South Loop location, which Related Midwest already has $500 million in TIP funds allocated to develop the land. So Related Midwest, rather very quickly, has gotten positive feedback from Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson, also the Chicago Federation of Labor President Bob Reeder, And the 3rd Ward Alderman Pat Dowell and even 11th Ward Alderman Nicole Lee was on record reported to be impressed with the proposed plans. Now, we could report at Sox Machine on Thursday night after speaking with Nicole Lee's team that the plan is for the 11th Ward is to not go down without a fight. Nicole Lee's office will be trying to keep the Chicago White Sox at 35th and Shields in the upcoming weeks, maybe even months. Lee's office will make the case that with the empty parking lots owned by the state, that the same kind of entertainment district that Related Midwest is pitching to state politicians can be built in Bridgeport. But Lee's office is making it clear they will not hand a blank check to Jerry Reinsdorf for such a project. They would need White Sox cooperation and investment into such a plan. Jim, because again, there's nothing going on for the White Sox on the field, this new stadium talk really has taken center stage with for all White Sox talks. And in case if you haven't heard the segment, podcast listeners, I recommend going on YouTube to 670 The Score, their YouTube page, and watch the debate between Matt Spiegel and our very good friend Lawrence Holmes. While it's a bit exciting to think that the White Sox could have a new stadium with an entertainment district that we see elsewhere around Major League Baseball, like Cincinnati has, and raved about that last year when we had our road trip at Cincinnati. Man, it'd be great if the White Sox had something like this outside the stadium. This project seems to be moving rather quickly that key state politicians outside of the governor of Illinois are already meeting, Jim, with the real estate developer. And to me, Related Midwest seems to be the culprit of wanting to move this very quickly and getting a new stadium deal on a parcel of land that they currently own in the South Loop. Like, it's not so much the White Sox. Mm-hmm. It's this real estate developer that's trying to make this happen, which maybe that's what Jerry Reinsdorf wanted all along. Hey, somebody do this for me.
Yeah. I mean, like, that's one of the benefits of having the deal that you have at Guaranteed Rate Field. The public funding is like, you don't really have to do anything. They get all the parking lot money. They don't pay fees on tickets below a certain amount. So it's just like, it's been very much a set it and forget it kind of deal. Obviously, with the way with interest rates rising and other pension shortages and such, not only in Illinois, but in other states, like it's been less popular and it's more known that it's not a great idea for states and cities to give money away to ballparks. So yeah, I imagine this time around, now that the public is a little bit wiser to all the ways ballpark funding doesn't pay off in the long run for a city, that yeah, let somebody else do the driving here. And you maybe still get the benefits of that bond extension, which is basically like, you know, money that could be going elsewhere, but instead goes to the White Sox or benefits the White Sox. But, you know, he doesn't have to do anything new for that. That's just an extension. You know, Related Midwest is already trying to move the train tracks and get like the public transportation in line to be able to have land available for something as big. So, I mean, like, it is a case of like, yeah, whenever somebody says, are you going to sell the team? He says, make me an offer. And it might be the same thing playing out ballpark for him. Like, are you going to move? Yeah. You know, going to move to Nashville? Are you going to move to outside the city? You going to move like, yeah, just somebody make me an offer. Tell me what's good. And in this case, like, it's probably very good. My reaction to the alderman's office talking about like how they don't want Jerry Reinsdorf having a blank check for develop a neighborhood. Like, I don't blame them, just because like one thing, when you look at these stories about the South Loop development and recapping all of the ways Guaranteed Rate Field was a mistake, it's like, that's one thing I don't want to see with the South Loop is like Jerry Reinsdorf having say on architecture or where the trends are going for ballpark development. And it's because basically he made every wrong call. And so I don't blame the alderman's office for saying like, if we're going to expand your influence on this neighborhood, put even bigger stamp on this area beyond parking lots and turning into buildings, like we want to make sure these buildings aren't as big a mistake as the ballpark was in terms of all the wrong choices that went into it. So yeah, even like the ballpark in Glendale, Camelback Ranch, like that's not, didn't turn out to be a great deal in terms of like,
nope,
a destination or design of the stadium with like how little shade it offers. It's far away from every other thing. Glendale is kind of a, you know, they whiffed on hockey and now they're playing in a college rink. So like, Glendale's kind of a mess. Like Reinsdorf got a free stadium out of it, but he made wrong choices there too, or at least like he didn't consider the choices important enough to make to really think about it. So I don't blame the alderman's office for saying like, we want to have input on how to develop this neighborhood, because the first chance at redeveloping what was, you know, parking lots into New Comiskey Park was, they did a pretty bad job of it. So if he gets another crack at it, he needs help.
It just, to me as a Bridgeport resident, like reading and hearing from parties, it seems like it's going to be a battle between this real estate development company and the 11th Ward, because clearly Bridgeport doesn't want to lose the White Sox. And you speak to other people who live in Bridgeport and it's like sad puppy syndrome. Like, this is not welcoming news for everyone outside in Chicago and the Chicago suburbs. And we've seen this on the Sox Machine comments as well, that there's a little bit of excitement about this. Like, okay, yeah, this might be easier for me in a commute, and saw the released renderings that probably should have not been released from Related Midwest. This is exciting. But everybody keeps saying that Guaranty Rate Field is not in a neighborhood. I mean, Commissioner Rob Manfred made that comment, right? That the neighborhood goes dark after games. And that couldn't be further from the truth. Like, I get it. You go to Guaranty Rate Field, if you're the commissioner of Major League Baseball, it's a lot easier to turn right out of the Guaranty Rate Field parking lot to hop on the highway than it is to go turning left down 35th over in the Halstead District, because that takes like 2 minutes. Like, oh, we got to get out of the south side of Chicago. It's scary down here. Like, yeah, I could totally see someone like Rob Manfred making that comment. But I assure you, Bridgeport,
he's not a Buffalo Wings and Rings guy.
He's not a Buffalo Wings and Rings guy. Must not like Chinese food. There's some great restaurants there. There's great restaurants in Morgan. Like, but then again, it's a very Chicago thing. Like, please do not come to my neighborhood. I love these places and they are not that busy right now. And I can go to them at any time, Jim. I can get a drink. I can get a meal. Don't have to wait, because I've been in other neighborhoods where things blow up and then it's a headache and you never go to those old places.
You're not anymore. Duck into the Duck Inn.
Yeah. The Duck Inn is a semifinalist for a James Beard Award, by the way. But it is a bit concerning that if this does become reality, like, what on the other side of the equation, like, what do you do with the current stadium? Like, I've heard and read that people have been pitching that maybe the Chicago Fire and the Chicago Red Stars, the soccer teams, could move in, which is fine, but that stadium would need funds to renovate seating to be more proper for a soccer stadium. And I looked this up, the city of Portland turned their old AAA baseball stadium into what is now the home of the Major League Soccer Portland Timbers and the National Women's Soccer League, the Portland Thorns. The city spent $38.5 million in 2000. 10 years later, spent an additional $31 million. And then there was an additional $85 million in private funding to complete the project so they could have a 25,000-seat capacity soccer stadium in what was an old AAA baseball stadium. Portland, along with public and private funding, spent $154 million to renovate their current stadium. So even if the White Sox move to the South Loop, somebody's going to need to come up with money to renovate the stadium if you do turn it into a soccer stadium. You still may want to develop that land. Like, yeah, I understand the 11th Ward now needing to come up with a plan, because if the White Sox do move, you have all these parking lots that are just empty. Now you got an empty baseball stadium. What are you going to do with all this land? Like, it is valuable land and the neighborhood is growing with more population, especially coming further south from Chinatown, as now it's 40% of the neighborhood in Bridgeport is Asian as far as the demographics go. So regardless, like I mentioned, like, the 11th Ward needs a plan, because Related Midwest, man, and you go to their website and they have already pulled off pretty impressive projects around the city of Chicago, especially in the West Loop. They got big plans and they seem to be the ones driving this the most, where last week I thought it was maybe the White Sox pushing this. But yeah, it really seems like this third party, Jim, is pushing for the White Sox to move to the South Loop, and it's going to turn into a pretty interesting conversation. And I wonder what Governor J.B. Pritzker, which side that he lands on, because this parcel of land not that long ago was supposed to build this new Illinois tech hub that J.B. Pritzker was at an announcement with then current then Mayor Lori Lightfoot, with plans of that opening on this parcel of land in 2026. So now sounds like he's not going to get that. And now he has to hear this pitch from the same real estate company that, instead of that, Governor Pritzker, we want to build a new stadium for the White Sox. I wonder how he's going to take that news.
I mean, like you mentioned that the real estate firm seems to be one that's driving it, and it seems like that might be why it's going so smoothly so far.
Don't want the White Sox negotiating.
Yeah, it's been remarkable. Like, I'm not sure if it's gaining momentum, but it's not losing momentum.
No.
Like, it's not, there's no...
It's definitely gaining momentum because of the positive vibes that are surrounding this. It is rare, Jim, for a Chicago project to get the mayor, the local alderman, and the president of the most powerful union labor in Illinois to say, this is a great idea.
Yeah.
Like, that is super rare.
Yeah, and it doesn't seem like the White Sox work that well with outside parties. Like, they're so, insular and such, so we're like getting all the cooperation this early would be rather startling. So yeah, it does make sense that if the real estate firm is the one driving it, like, that explains why this has been so well rolled out, this introductory phase, to where people have warmed up to it. There's still the question. The reason I don't want to get ahead of myself and say it's gaining momentum is because there's still a big unanswered question about, like,
right,
where is all the money coming from? And I think that's one that's too important to like treat as like, yeah, we'll get to it when we get to it, because cities and states have made that mistake over and over again. So I guess, being on the side of having a platform, you want to stop short of cheerleading it without knowing exactly where the money is coming from and say, like, my stance is more, this is kind of interesting, just how every week or so there's a new update where there isn't that snag yet, which I think, I keep expecting the next update will be, they're at loggerheads with the governor, or they don't have the buy-in from, and like, no, it's all good so far. So hats off to them for at least the, nailing the early news cycles really well.
It's a lot better than what's going on in Vegas.
Yeah. I mean, that's the counterpoint that, hey, I mentioned this when talking about like the Orioles sale too, is just like everybody who talks about the White Sox moving to Nashville, wherever, it's like the A's are showing how hard it is and why Major League Baseball has avoided it for so long, moving the A's or moving the Rays, like rather finding a stadium in their market, because it's a real pain in the butt to try to get out of a current lease and go to a market that does not have a ballpark yet. Like, you can't make an analog you can't make an analogy to the 1980s, because the Suncoast Dome was just sitting there ready for baseball. That's why so many teams were able to use it successfully as leverage, because like any year, any team could have gone there, give them like 4 months notice, they'll get the field there and they'll get the marketing ready. They had everything ready to go. And teams just kept using them over and over again to get better deals. So that's why, like, when you look at, what the A's are going through without having that ballpark built in advance, or not even having like renderings for a ballpark, and then trying to piece together like a 3-year plan, not playing in the Coliseum, but also not playing in a to be announced ballpark, you get in this really sketchy area where you don't know like where you're going to be playing, if you're going to be getting the kind of TV money you thought you were getting originally in Oakland, if players are going to be cool with, being in this weird nomadic year-to-year situation, like, it's a big mess. So that's why I think, I've never really taken the threat of relocation seriously, because the league has never, or the league has done everything possible, I think, to avoid relocation in the most desperate markets, and the White Sox are not a desperate market.
I'm going to give this 60 seconds before we move on to the other topics, folks. But for the Vegas situation, I think that's more on John Fisher and his incompetency.
Yeah, he's like a dummy.
the more I read about him and the more that very smart writers in San Francisco write about him, like with Angelos now leaving, yeah, John Fisher is by far the worst owner in Major League Baseball. And not only was he awful to Oakland A's fans, he might suck at business. Like he just might be, I'm rich because my parents owned Gap. And Gap kicked off Banana Republic and kicked off Old Navy. Like, that's why I'm rich. I'm rich. I'm a Nepo baby. John Fisher's pretty much a Nepo baby. Yeah.
Phil, yeah. Son.
And he's proven his worth right now because in 2 months, Bally's, the casino company, is tearing down Tropicana. They're tearing down that hotel and resort. So ready or not, John Fisher, we're getting this land ready to develop, and you better be ready to start developing the land. So go find your money that you said that you had when you got approval from Nevada government to move forward at this project. And I mentioned this comment section. If John Fisher continues to fumble the bag, I wonder behind the scenes if Major League Baseball and the other 29 owners try to force him out. Like, you need to sell. We can't have you. You can't keep doing this. You can't keep screwing this up. This is all.
We have standards. So,
we have standards. Yeah, it's a country club. And you're not meeting. You're not meeting the
and
standards.
And they don't even have standards, really. That's how bad it is.
Exactly. Meanwhile, I mentioned Portland. The Portland Baseball Group that's trying to get a Major League Baseball team, they bought a golf course in Portland, 164-acre golf course, and they're going to start developing renderings and plans on how they could develop that area for a new baseball stadium and entertainment district. So Portland technically is farther ahead than Nashville. Portland's got land where Nashville does not at the moment. So yeah, it seems to be, this could be the big talk with Major League Baseball the next 5 years, folks. New stadiums, relocations, franchise teams with the new CBA, and that will all lay it out on how new teams could be added. So if you love chaos, we could be getting it pretty soon and where teams actually play games. We're going to take a quick break for a word from our sponsors. But after the break, let's speculate why Blake Snell, Jordan Montgomery, and Cody Bellinger are still free agents. And will old friends Tim Anderson and Yasmani Grandal find new homes before spring training? Next on the Sox Machine podcast. We at Sox Machine have a special event planned on Wednesday night, March 27th at the newly reopened Remova Theater. Along with our friends from the 108, we'll be hosting a live Sox Machine podcast to kick off the 2024 regular season and celebrate opening day. There'll be special guests, giveaways, and plenty of hashtag 108ing as you'll get to mingle with other White Sox fans. This is a seated event where you have to be 18 years or older to attend. Tickets are just $22, which you can purchase at RemovaChicago.com. That's all one word, RemovaChicago.com. And Jim and I, we can't wait to see everyone at our opening day Eve show at the Remova Theater.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/BlueWire. Just go to Indeed.com/BlueWire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/BlueWire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Welcome back to the Sox Machine podcast. All right, so after talking about the Corbin Burns trade and White Sox new stadium talk, we're going to talk about Major League Baseball here because, again, pitchers and catchers are going to report on February 14th in the Cactus League. I believe they report February 13th in the Grapefruit League in Florida. And then full squads show up 5 days later. So spring training is rapidly coming. And it kind of harkens back to the 2019 offseason. If you recall, that's when the White Sox failed to sign Manny Machado, and Bryce Harper ended up signing with Philadelphia into spring training. Both of those players were still, they're the biggest free agents of that class, and they signed very late. Well, the biggest free agents have already signed, but you still have big free agents available in starting pitchers Jordan Montgomery and the National League Cy Young winner Blake Snell, and then Cody Bellinger, one of the top position players in this free agency class, still available. So, Jim, it harkens this question in my mind, like, what's going on? Why haven't Jordan Montgomery, Blake Snell, and Cody Bellinger have signed? So let's start with Blake Snell, because it seems like word on the street is that his agent, of course, Scott Boras, and I think Scott Boras represents all three players, that Boras is seeking a 9-year contract for Blake Snell, along the same lines that Gerrit Cole signed with the New York Yankees. And I'm wondering, at this stage of the offseason, is anyone going to budge and meet Boras's asking price for Blake Snell, or do you not buy that rumor, Jim?
That seems like a lot for a pitcher who's already 30. Like, I would think like 9 years would be like, oh, you know, 27, 28, hit the ground running as a prospect, and then got called up and you never went back down to the minors and is hitting free agency in his prime. And sure, like Gerrit Cole, like, you know, that kind of deal. And Blake Snell, you know, because he, you know, led the league in walks last year, because he's never thrown more than 180 innings and he's only done that twice. Like, he's either thrown 180 innings or he's thrown 130 innings. Like, he's not somebody who throws like 160 with regularity and qualifies for the ERA title. When he qualifies for the ERA title, he wins the Cy Young, but, when he doesn't, like, it's just, he's missing basically a month plus the season. And if a pitcher's already 30 and has already had like the ups and downs with availability and his in-start stamina isn't necessarily the best, to go back to like the Dylan Cease thing, I can understand why teams aren't just like super excited about like paying top dollar for him. You know, trading for the Rays deal, the extension that they signed him to is like 5 years, $50 million or something along those lines. Like, acquiring the remainder of that for 3 years of his prime. Sure, that makes all, you know, that makes plenty of sense, because you can still have plenty of cash to spend around him and really fortify the rotation the way that the Padres did with like getting Yu Darvish as well. So that makes sense. But having Snell as like the centerpiece of a rotation and taking up all of the money versus being like a secondary salary where maybe you can spend the money to get a more reliable pitcher, whether start to start or, you know, over the course of a season, having a better feeling about getting 170 plus innings than Snell really gives you. I think that could be like a sticking point in just like how bad teams want somebody like him. And, you know, Scott Boras is very good at his job, but sometimes his approach backfires when the player isn't quite the right player for that hard of a line. And while I'm reluctant to doubt him, just because he tends to pull these deals out, like even if he has to wait to mid-March to do so, the weaknesses that Snell has, I think, are notable enough to say, like, yeah, pump the brakes a little bit.
I could see a team maybe agreeing to like a 5-year deal for Blake Snell, like 5 years, $150 million, $30 million per season. He'd still be one of the highest paid pitchers in Major League Baseball with that type of contract construction. But if Boras is asking for 9 years, as you mentioned, Jim, he's stubborn enough to hold on and advise his client to wait. Somebody will eventually budge. It brings to mind, though, then Jordan Montgomery, because as we saw this past season on how valuable Jordan Montgomery can be, he can't make the same case for Blake Snell to merit that length of a contract. But I really thought Jordan Montgomery would have been one of the first starting pitchers to be signed, that teams wouldn't mind signing him to a 4 or 5 year deal. Is there something that I'm missing? Because in my offseason plan, when I foolishly came up with an idea that maybe the White Sox can contend if they hold a $180 million payroll, which they're not going to come anywhere close to that type of payroll, that the White Sox should sign someone like Jordan Montgomery to help lead the rotation. I still think that would be a good idea, but the White Sox are not going to explore that. So don't get your hopes up, folks. But I am shocked that no other teams have signed Montgomery to this day.
Yeah, I mean, like, I think Boris having both players like is the easy explanation, especially, and I'm not sure, like, it would seem to be a conflict of interest if you're trying to use one player to set the market for the other, you know, and then you kind of get in this endless standoff with yourself almost, if you're passing up like acceptable deals for your client because you're holding out for a better one for another one. So I don't know if that's like something that's possible in those ranks, but like there are two opposite pitchers, like in terms of Snell's weaknesses, walks too many batters, often gets hurt and misses starts. Like Montgomery can't say the same. He doesn't really walk batters. He keeps the ball in the park pretty well. He's good for 150 plus innings, at least the last 3 years. Like he's been able to make 30 starts. He's been able to qualify for the ERA title. So like that's been points in his favor. So like you would think that if teams aren't really excited about Snell, those teams would be interested or excited about Montgomery, you know, maybe going a year longer than they'd like to, the kind of standard inefficiency of free agent contracts, because you're getting the skill set you want and you'll worry about the 2028 complications when you get to it, whatever the deal ends up being. So that confuses me a little bit, aside from the Boris factor. The one thing with Montgomery is that it really seems like he wants to go back to the Rangers, or at least that was kind of the initial thought. And the Rangers are tied up in the Bally Sports deal. You know, what's the future with that? How much are they going to get for TV deals? And so they really haven't been spending. And I think that's why the Mariners are in an interesting position of like catching the Rangers as they regress a little bit and as they just try to get by on the money they spent last year, because they won their World Series, so they don't need to push as hard to enjoy the windfall from what they accomplished. So I can see the Rangers not being, you know, all that excited about them, and I can see like the Cardinals not maybe having, you know, they don't spend as freely as other teams to where like they knock Scott Boris's socks off with like a huge contract. Like they spend money. They just, you know, it's not like they don't spend the kind of free agent money where like going back to Gerrit Cole at the Yankees, like a team saying like, oh, I can't compete with that. Or in the case of like even Carlos Rodon, the deal he signed with the Yankees, like everybody saying like, yeah, that's good for Rodon. Yankees can afford that, but like, I'm glad I didn't sign. You know, like you can kind of see, the Cardinals are on that tier below, even though they do spend. So I can see like that they're not going to go guns blazing for Montgomery, especially since they just had him and he didn't make a difference in terms of what they didn't accomplish during the first half of last season. So maybe they're thinking like, yeah, I don't want to, you know, get caught in a bidding war against myself when we know that he didn't reverse the course of our team already. So if those are the two teams he kind of wants to play for, or that are interested, and they're just for one reason or another tempering their enthusiasm, then I can see kind of getting this loop of, do the Angels get desperate, you know, because they're a team that can occasionally spend stupid money you know, get the deal they want. But it is, you know, the TV deal, I think, because that's the reason why the Twins aren't spending, even though they just are, you know, they won division, had an attendance boost, seem well positioned every other way to spend, and they aren't. Like that could be a case where Montgomery's the kind of market that would be going nuts for Montgomery just is a little bit held back by what, I guess, not being sure what their income is going to be next year.
And then finally, Cody Bellinger. If I'm a Chicago Cubs fan and I can sense the irritation, especially in social media, like why haven't the Cubs signed Cody Bellinger? Like that just seems bizarre to me. Like, I understand the Cubs are like, we like Pico Armstrong. He's going to be our center fielder. That's fine. You could still use Cody Bellinger. Like, Bellinger's another one that I'm really surprised. Like, the Yankees don't make sense now because they got Juan Soto, and that outfield is pretty packed now. There's a part of me that just, I wish that Jerry Reinsdorf would just wake up and be like, you know what, Scott? $27 million for 1 year of Cody Bellinger. Would Bellinger play one season with the Chicago White Sox and probably get traded in July? Like, it's not even a full season, like half a season. So really, you'd just be on the hook for like $13.5 million to give White Sox fans false hope that they could be anything in 2024. Maybe they could. And maybe everyone breaks out. Mikata, Jimenez, Vaughn, they all break out along with Luis Robert, and then Bellinger comes in, and then all of a sudden they have a lineup. They're scoring runs. Like, this is pie in the sky type of thinking, but there's a part of me that's like, if nobody wants Cody Bellinger, why not the White Sox? But we know why the White Sox won't. But I'm still confused on, like, why the Cubs haven't gotten a deal done, or anyone for that matter.
Yeah, the outfield market's been pretty dismal. I guess Matt Chapman is another one in the market as well.
Like, yeah, kind of that's being a good point.
Being the Cody Bellinger among infielders and not finding a home yet. Like, another guy whose defense helps make up for the inconsistencies in his offense. Like, offers a lot offensively when everything's going right. When things aren't quite clicking, he plays defense well enough to help out there and weather the... you know, if it's inconsistency, health, what have you, that sometimes keeps, a player in a rut for a month. So yeah, it's a case where, like, you know, Boris being Boris, like, this is the reason why, like, fans don't like him and teams don't like him. And just like why he's a good nemesis for, I think, a lot of parties in baseball is because, like, he does hold out. And while, you know, labor-minded baseball fans always want to prioritize, yeah, these are free agents. They have agency to decide where they go and wait as long as they can to get top dollar. It does suppress the excitement of, like, getting your new toy and just imagining all the ways your lineup can go and kind of drawing up strategies against lefties and righties. And the guy like Bellinger, where do we play him? Center, left, right, first base? Like, how do we maximize a skill set? And then, like, if he comes back, it's like, it's already spring training. So, you know, that kind of excitement of what normally would have been like a winter meeting signing, it does make the winter a little less special. So that's, yeah, I think the problem with, like, one agent cornering the market the way that Boris has. But yeah, it's thinking about Bellinger and the White Sox, like, Chris gets a strategy of defense. Like, what if defense, but offense? Like,
yeah.
It's fun to pretend.
It is fun to pretend. And then finally, old friends, Tim Anderson and Yasmani Grandal, still free agents. There's a part of me that's not surprised that they're still free agents, Jim, even though there were those early rumors back in November, mid-November, when there was speculation that the Angels could pursue Tim Anderson and have Tim Anderson be their second baseman, especially after hiring manager Ron Washington. And I always felt like that could be a good pairing at some point to help Anderson's career, since Wash has done a terrific job everywhere that he's gone in helping middle infielders develop. Of course, his big success story is Marcus Semien when Wash was in Oakland. That obviously hasn't come to fruition. And I'm wondering here, again, spring training's in a couple weeks, Jim. Are Tim Anderson and Yasmani Grandal still going to be unemployed? Do you think they're going to find homes in the next 2 weeks?
I think Anderson could. Elvis Andrew signed a deal with the White Sox to play second base right as spring training was starting. And I think Anderson has a similar case. Like, any team that could use upside, whether as, like, the projected worst infielder on the team, like, if a team only needs a second baseman and they don't have anybody that's currently replacement level, like, that would be a team, like, yeah, sign Tim Anderson. Because if he's great, like, if he's all-star level again, or at least what all-star level was before, like, all the infielders were good and it became a lot harder to crack a top 10 list, like, that's all of a sudden huge upside for, like, top of the order or bottom of the order if he's the guy turning it over. And, you know, if you're a team that could use upside just in order to have potential players move at the deadline, that's another case where, yeah, may as well sign him because he's not going to cost much, especially the way he played last year. I wrote about this a little bit, just saying, like, it seems like the teams that wanted something specific from the position, like with the White Sox getting Paul DeJong and Nicky Lopez to solidify the middle infield and put glove first guys behind a pitching staff that needs all the defensive help it can get. Like, Anderson's not that kind of guy. Like, if you want offense, like, especially with the way Anderson played last year, he's a hard guy to bet on as well. That's why I really think it put him in a really tough position for teams that are acquiring, say, like, what's the most likely thing we're going to get out of him? Or if all else fails, what does he provide? And last year, Tim Anderson's game failed completely. Like, I think the only thing he did well was steal bases, but he didn't get on base enough to steal bases. So he only stole like 12 or 13. So like, you can't count on that. He didn't defend well, didn't get on base, just seemed kind of out of it. The whole team was out of it, but just when it came to, he wasn't his usual self on the field, in the dugout, in the clubhouse, etc. So like, what is this guy now? So I can see just this being a long winter for him in terms of recognizing his new value and then just trying to figure out the best place where he can rehabilitate his value in a hurry. So he might be picky a little bit to make sure that he doesn't get blocked or kind of walled off on a team and being like a bench guy, because I think he really does need to start in order to try to recapture what he had. But I can see teams that want certainty in one aspect, just looking at Anderson saying, I'm not sure what that certainty is, because even if he's good, he may not stay healthy. That's the other thing working against him. So it's tough because it's, as fun as he is when everything's going right, you hate to see somebody just kind of lose all his mojo in 1 year. So I'm hoping that he finds a deal that works for him, just give him the playing time that he needs to put all together. Grandal, I think, like, if he retired, I imagine he'd be fine.
Yeah.
Like, he's accomplished plenty. He, he's made generational money. You can call it a good career. I don't know if he wants to be anybody's backup. I don't know if a team would want him as a backup. Another case of like, what does he do well? When you say like the way the White Sox pitching staff collapsed when he was there, he didn't really help. I'm not sure if he's going to like steward a pitching staff, if he's going to shepherd other young catchers. I don't know if he's going to offer that. So he might not be like a Martin Maldonado, make everybody better around you, including former fellow catchers. So he just might be content to be like, yeah, it's a career.
He could be. Yeah. I mean, I
you get so used to starting, like, just you might not be that kind of guy who has to play second banana and be the helper.
I could see it. I could see Grandal retiring. Tim Anderson, we'll see. But, yeah, it was not that long ago that we raved that both of these players could be dark horse MVP candidates for the White Sox. And here we are on February 1st, 2024, as we record this podcast episode, and they're still free agents, but they're not alone. There's still many free agents out there. Even the big name free agents still don't know where they will be reporting to for spring training in a couple of weeks. But that will do it for this episode of the Sox Machine podcast. But before we sign off, we kind of buried the lead here for Sox Machine. We have some major news, major site news that we're going to be announcing on Monday, February 5th. And we're not trying to deliberately be coy. Is that the right phrase here, Jim? Like, we'll be making this announcement on Monday. But with this particular announcement, again, we'll be live streaming. The live stream will be at 12 p.m. Central Time on Monday. And we'll have that news also on Monday on SoxMachine.com. But we're very excited for this big news that we're going to be announcing on Monday.
Yes, it's come together very quickly. So Monday is, I think, literally the soonest we could possibly do it. Like the emails, the Google workspace is smoking right now with everything we have to send back and forth to get this going. But yeah, it is. I would consider it a transformational change for Sox Machine. And with that, we have not, since we launched on Patreon as a Patreon supported site in 2018, we have not changed the pricing tiers because we didn't have a reason to charge more aside from like adjusting for inflation, maybe making a little bit more money, that sort of thing. But we didn't want to touch the pricing tiers. We just wanted to continue growing the community because we figured that was more important. And if we charged more, we want it to be like a specific reason, like, here's why we need more money. You're going to see your value from this. And that moment has arrived. So we are very excited about it. It does come with like a slight trepidation just because we will be changing or revising the Patreon pricing structure quite a bit in order to accommodate this. But we really feel like it's worth it. Really excited about it. Can't wait for Monday, because that'll mean like all our work is done, first of all, but also because like, it's huge news. And really can't wait to get started on a new era of Sox Machine.
And you guessed it. we're moving to the South. I'm kidding.
Yes.
I'm kidding. But yes, Monday, 12 p.m. Central Time, we'll be streaming live on our YouTube channel, on Twitch, on Twitter, and SoxMachine.com. So
good time to subscribe to the YouTube channel because you'll get notified when we're going live in case you happen to forget. You're busy with your work day and realize like, oh, I forgot about the Sox Machine live announcement. You'll get notifications if you are subscribed when we're about to go live.
Yes. So again, that'll be our next episode from us because we got a lot of work to do from here and there. We also got to do a lot of curling.
Yes.
On Saturday. Can't wait to see a lot of you guys at Windy City Curling. Don't ask what the big announcement is going to be at the curling event. We're going to be not telling you, and you're going to be extra angry at us and throwing a 40-pound stone on the ice at me. It's not going to be great. But, yeah, can't wait to see everyone at curling and can't wait to talk to you guys on Monday, with the exception if Dylan Cease, of course, gets traded over the weekend. You will obviously hear from us on Sox Machine.
And that's the last thing we need right now.
That really is the last thing that we need right now. If you are listening, Chris Getz. But that will do it for this episode of the Sox Machine Podcast. Thank you guys so much for listening. If you just discovered the Sox Machine Podcast, you can subscribe to the show wherever you listen to podcasts such as Spotify and Apple Music. As Jim mentioned, subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/SoxMachine. For the podcast listeners that listen to the show through Google Podcasts, please note in March, Google will be migrating you from Google Podcasts over to YouTube to listen to the podcast, which we do upload our podcast episodes into our YouTube channel. So please be aware of that change that's coming in a month. And you can follow us on social media. We're on all the platforms at the Sox Machine. You can follow me there as well at SoxMachine_Josh. The Sox Machine Podcast is a production of SoxMachine.com. You're on for all things Chicago White Sox baseball. Alongside Jim Margulis, I'm Josh Nelson. Thanks for listening and watching.